In the anteroom of the initiation chamber, he found a green tunic and tight black trousers draped over a costumer. He didn't want to put them on. It was probably some sort of uniform of this idiotic cult, and he wanted no part of it. But there weren't any other clothes. There was also a beautiful pair of black boots. Everything fit perfectly and comfortably. There was a full-length mirror on the wall, and he looked at himself and grudgingly admitted that the outfit was a gas. A tiny golden apple glinted on the left side of his chest. The only thing was that his hair needed washing. It was getting stringy. Through two more doors, and he was facing Hagbard.
"You didn't like our little ceremony?"
said Hagbard with exaggerated sympathy.
"That's too bad. I was so proud of it. Especially the parts I lifted from William Burroughs and the Marquis de Sade."
"It's sick," said George. "And putting the woman inside the apple so I couldn't have any kind of personal sex with her, so I had to use her as a receptacle, as an object? You made it pornographic and sadistic pornography at that."
"Did, George,"
said Hagbard.
"Thou art that. If there were no death, there would be no sex. If there were no sex, there would be no death, and without sex, there would be no evolution toward intelligence, no human race. Therefore, death is necessary. Death is the price of orgasm. Only one being on all this planet is sexless, intelligent, and immortal. While you were pumping your seeds into the symbol of life, I showed you orgasm and death in one image and brought it home to you, and you'll never forget it. It was a trip, George. Wasn't it a trip?"
George nodded reluctantly.
"It was a trip.
And you know, in your bones, a little more about life than you did before, right, George?"
"Yes."
"Well then, thank you for joining the Legion of Dynamic Discord."
"You're welcome."
Hagbard beckoned George to the edge of the boat-shaped balcony. He pointed down. Far below, in the blue-green medium through which they seemed to be flying, George could see rolling lands, hills, winding riverbeds, and then broken buildings. George gasped. Pyramids rose up below, as high as the hills.
"This is one of the great port cities,"
Hagbard said.
"Galleys from the Americas plied their trade to and from this harbor for 1,000 years.
"How long ago?"
10,000 years, said Hagbard. "This was one of the last cities to go. Of course, their civilization had declined quite a bit by then. Meanwhile, we've got a problem. The Illuminati are here already."
A large, undulating blue-gray shape appeared ahead of them, swam toward them, whirled and matched their speed so it seemed to drift alongside. George felt another momentary leap of fright. Was this another of Hagbard's tricks?
"What is that fish? How does it keep up with us?"
George asked.
"It's a porpoise, not a fish. A mammal. And they can swim a lot faster than submarines can sail underwater. We can keep up with them, though. They form a film around their bodies that enables them to slide through the water without setting up any turbulence. I learned from them how to do it, and I applied it to this sub. We can cross the Atlantic underwater in less than a day."
A voice spoke from the control panel.
"Better go transparent. You'll be within range of their detectors when you've gone another 10 miles.
"Right,"
said Hagbard.
"We will maintain present course until further notice, so you'll know where we are."
"I'll know,"
said the voice. Hagbard slashed his hand through the air disgustedly.
"You're so fucking superior."
"Who are you talking to?"
said George.
"Howard."
The voice said,
"I've never seen machines like this before. They look something like crabs. They've just about got the temple all dug up."
"When the Illuminati do something on their own, they go first class,"
said Hagbard.
"Who the hell is Howard?"
said George.
"It's me, out here. Hello, Mr. Human,"
said the voice.
"I'm Howard."
Unbelieving, yet knowing quite well what was happening, George slowly turned his head. The dolphin appeared to be looking at him.
"How does he talk to us?"
said Hagbard.
"He's swimming alongside the prow of the submarine, which is where we pick up his voice. My computer translates from Delphine to English. A mic here in the control room sends our voices to the computer, which translates into Delphine and broadcasts the correct sounds through the water to him.
Lady, oh, oh, deal day, a new human being has come my way.
Howard sang.
He has swum into my ken. I hope he's one of the friendly men.
They sing a lot,
said Hagbard.
Also recite poetry and make it up on the spot. A large part of their culture is poetry, poetics and athletics. And, of course, the two are very closely related. What they do mostly is swim, hunt, and communicate with each other.
But we do all with artful complexity and rare finesse,
said Howard, looping the loop outside.
Lead us to the enemy, Howard,
said Hagbard. Howard swam out in front of them, and as he did so, he sang,
Ride on, ride on, a stream against the foe. The sallying schools of the southern seas make their course to go. Attack, attack, with noses sound as rock. No shark or squid can shake us loose or survive our 2-hour shock.
Epics,
said Hagbard.
They're mad for epics. They have their whole story for the past 40,000 years in epic form. No books, no writing. How could they handle pens with their fins, you know? All memorization. Which is why they favor poetry. And their poems are marvelous. But you must spend years studying their language before you know that. Our computer turns their works into doggerel. It's the best it can do. When I have time, I'll add some circuits that can really translate poetry from one language to another. When the porpoise corpus is translated into human languages, it will advance our culture by centuries or more. It will be as if we discovered the works of a whole race of Shakespeares that have been writing for 40 millennia.
On the other hand,
said Howard,
your civilizations may be demoralized by culture shock.
Not likely,
said Hagbard grumpily.
We've a few things to teach you, you know.
And our psychotherapist can help you over the anguish of digesting our knowledge,
said Howard.
They have psychotherapists,
said George.
They invented psychoanalysis thousands of years ago as a means of passing the time on long migrations. They have highly complex brains and symbol systems, but their minds are unlike ours in very important ways. They are all in one piece, so to speak. They lack the structural differentiation of ego, superego, and id. There is no repression. They are fully aware and accepting of their most primitive wishes and conscious will, rather than parent-inculcated discipline, guides their actions. There is no neurosis, no psychosis among them. Psychoanalysis for them is an imaginative, poetic exercise in autobiography, rather than a healing art. There are no difficulties of the mind that require healing.
Not quite true,
said Howard.
There was a school of thought about 20,000 years ago that envied humans. They were called the original sinners because they were like the first parents of your human race who, according to some of your legends, envied the gods and suffered for it. They taught the humans were superior because they could do many more things than dolphins, but they despaired and most ended up by committing suicide. They were the only neurotics in the long history of porpoises. Our philosophers mostly hold on that we live in beauty all the days of our lives as no human does. Our culture is simply what you might call a commentary on our natural surroundings, whereas human culture is at war with nature. If any race is afflicted, it is yours. You can do much, and what you can do, you must do. And, speaking of war, the enemy lies ahead.
In the distance, George could make out what appeared to be a mighty city rising on hills surrounding a deep depression, which must have been a harbour when Atlantis was on the surface. The buildings marched on and on as far as the eye could see. They were mostly low, but here and there a square tower reared up. The sub was heading for the centre of the ancient waterfront. George stared at the buildings. He was able to see them better now. They were angular, very modern in appearance, whereas the other city they'd flown sailed over, had a mixed Greek-Egyptian Mayan quality to its architecture. Here, there were no pyramids, but the tops of many of the structures were broken off, and many others were heaps of rubble. Still, it was remarkable that a city which had sunk so many thousands of feet to the bottom of the ocean in the course of what must have been an enormous earthquake should be this well preserved. The buildings must be incredibly durable. If New York went through a catastrophe like that, there'd be nothing left of its glass and alloy skyscrapers. There was one pyramid. It was much smaller than the towers around it. It gleamed a dull yellow. Despite its lack of height, it seemed to dominate the harbour skyline like a squat, powerful chieftain in the centre of a circle of tall, slender warriors. There was movement around its base.
"This is the city of Paos in the region of Poseida," said Hagbard. "And it was great in Atlantis for 1,000 years after the hour of the Dragon Star. It reminds me of Byzantium, which was a great city for 1,000 years after the fall of Rome. And that pyramid is the Temple of Tethys, a goddess of the ocean sea. It was seafaring that made Paos great. I have a soft spot in my heart for those people."
Crawling around the base of the temple were strange sea creatures that looked like giant spiders. Lights flashed from their heads and glinted on the sides of the temple. As the submarine swept closer, George could see that the spiders were machines, each with a body the size of a tank. They appeared to be excavating deep trenches around the base of the pyramid.
"Wonder where they had those built,"
muttered Hagbard.
"Hard to keep innovations like that a secret."
As he spoke, the spiders stopped whatever work they were doing around the pyramid. There was no motion among them at all for a moment. Then one of them rose up from the sea bottom, followed by another and another. They formed quickly into a V-shape and started toward the submarine like a pair of arms outstretched to seize it. They picked up speed as they came.
"They've detected us,"
Hagbard growled.
"They weren't supposed to, but they have. It never pays to underestimate the Illuminati. All right, George, button up your asshole. We're in for a fight."
At that moment, but exactly 2 hours earlier on the clock, Rebecca Goodman awoke from a dream about Saul and a Playboy bunny and something sinister. The phone was ringing. Was there a pyramid in the dream? She tried to remember something like that, and she reached groggily past the mermaid statue and held the receiver to her ear.
"Yes?"
she said cautiously.
"Put your hand on your pussy and listen,"
said August Personage.
"I'd like to lift your dress and..."
Rebecca hung up. She suddenly remembered the hit when the needle went in and all those wasted years. Saul had saved her from that, and now Saul was gone, and strange voices on the phone talked of sex, the way addicts talked of junk. "In the beginning of all things was Mamu, the spirit of pure chaos. In the beginning was the word, and it was written by a baboon." Rebecca Goodman, 25 years old, started to cry. If he's dead, she thought, these years have been wasted too. Learning to love. Learning that sex was more than another kind of junk. Learning that tenderness was more than a word in the dictionary. That it was just what D.H. Lawrence said. Not an embellishment on sex, but the centre of the act. Learning what that poor guy on the phone could never guess. As most people in this crazy country never guessed it. And then losing it. Losing it to an aimless bullet. Fired from a blind gun somewhere. August Personage, about to leave the phone booth at the automat on 40th Street and the Avenue of the Americas, catches a flash of plastic on the floor. Bending, he picks up a pornographic tarot card. He quickly shoves it into a pocket to be examined at leisure later. It was the Five of Pentacles. And when the throne room was empty, and the believers had departed in wonder and redoubled faith, Hassan knelt and separated the two halves of the vessel which had held the head of Ibn Azif.
Very convincing screams,
he commented, slipping the trapdoor beneath the plate, and Ibn Azif climbed out, grinning at his own performance. His neck was thick, bull-like, undamaged, and quite solid.